Today's reading is from the book of Matthew, chapter 24, verses 36 to 51. But concerning that day and hour, no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, nor the Son, but the Father only. For as were the days of Noah, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. For as in those days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, until the day when Noah entered the ark. And they were unaware until the flood came and swept them all away. So will be the coming of the Son of Man. Then two men will be in the field. One will be taken and one left. Two women will be grinding at the mill. One will be taken and one left. Therefore, stay awake, for you do not know on what day your Lord is coming. But know this, that if the master of the house had known in what part of the night the thief was coming, he would have stayed awake and would not have let his house be broken into. Therefore, you also must be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour you do not expect. Who then is the faithful and wise servant whom his master has set over his household to give them their food at the proper time? Blessed is that servant whom his master will find so doing when he comes. Truly, I say to you, he will set him over all his possessions. But if that wicked servant says to himself, my master is delayed, and begins to beat his fellow servants and eats and drinks with drunkards, the master of that servant will come on a day where he does not expect him, and at an hour he does not know, and will cut him in pieces and put him with the hypocrites. In that place there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. This is the word of the Lord.
In my first year after moving to Leipzig, I spent a weekend in Prague. If you haven't visited it yet, I thoroughly recommend it. It's a beautiful city with a lot of culture. I particularly liked all the ornate bridges across the river. But the most popular attraction in Prague is something else. It's a clock, the Prague Astronomical Clock. Installed in 1410, it's the oldest clock in the world that's still in operation. It's not an ordinary clock. It has dials representing the position of the sun, the moon, and the stars of the zodiac. Every hour, a huge crowd gathers in the town square, and the clock puts on a performance as it strikes the hour. There are animated figures representing death, vanity, lust, and greed. Death is a skeleton who strikes the hour, and the other figures put on animated displays. Then there's a procession of 12 apostles. It's all very elaborate and a lot of fun for little kids to watch. But as I was there watching this, I got the feeling the whole experience was a little bit weird. Some of the cleverest engineers and the most skilled craftsmen in Europe had used their talents to create a mechanical puppet show? Why? Well, I think they were showing off a bit. In the Cold War, the Soviet Union showed they were the greatest by sending a man into space. The Americans showed they were even greater by putting a man on the moon. But back in the Middle Ages, you showed your technical greatness by making the most sophisticated clock. Just as the superpowers showed they'd conquered space, the medievals showed they'd conquered time. And so everyone was making sophisticated clocks. And the success of clocks like this made people think this was the way the world works. The universe is a gigantic clock. And it affected people's view of God too. The Prague clock, with all its apostles and moral figures, was explicitly religious. And the hymn, Crown Him with Many Crowns, has a final verse which is quite odd. It describes God as creator of the rolling spheres. It's wonderful sounding language, but it's a reference to the crystal spheres that they believed the planets were attached to. They thought the author of the hymn believed that the universe was clockwork. And there was an argument for the existence of God because you need a watchmaker to make this incredible clock. The philosopher Descartes suggested the cosmos was a watch created and wound up by the great watchmaker. But the problem is, if the universe is a clock, once God wound it up, he didn't actually have to do anything anymore. He could then play golf or whatever watchmakers do for recreation. This leads to types of religion called deism, where you believe there's a god or deity who made the world, but then abandoned it. This is not the living God of the Bible. But this clockwork universe was destroyed when people like Einstein showed that time doesn't work like that. The universe contains really weird things like black holes, and it's full of time paradoxes. Time is a web of cause and effect, but it's all stretchy like a sheet of rubber. And Einstein's friends showed that on a detailed level, the world is fundamentally unpredictable. These days, everyone knows the universe is not a clock. But if the world were a clock, it would be completely predictable. And one of the wonderful things about clocks is that they make waiting easier. You know that Gary's flight doesn't arrive for another 2 hours, so we have time to do some shopping in the airport while we're waiting. Even better is alarm clocks. I put a chicken in the oven, set an alarm for a few hours, and then I can completely forget about it until the alarm goes off. But from this passage in Matthew, we see that far from being a clock that is wound up and abandoned, we live in a world that is profoundly unstable. The world is delicately balanced on the tip of God's finger. I'm imagining when you balance a broom on your hand, constantly in motion. Every second, the world continues because God has not ended it. Our reading today is actually part of a large section of the Gospel of Matthew in which Jesus talks about the end times and the coming judgment. The section begins at the start of chapter 24, where he talks about the future destruction of the temple, and ends at the end of chapter 25. Immediately after that, in chapter 26, the crucifixion begins. And so these are some of the last things that Jesus said in his earthly ministry. This is 2 days before he was killed. He's a lamb heading to the slaughter. And so what does he talk about? He talks about the end of the world. And what does he say about it? Verse 36. And this is important and it's worth looking at. Make sure that the Bible really says this. Concerning that day and hour, no one knows. Nobody knows the precise time of judgment day. Jesus will repeat this statement in various ways again and again over the next few paragraphs. But to simply say that you don't know when the Lord will return understates how deep our level of ignorance is. There are many things I don't know. I don't know if my mother in Australia is awake right now. I don't know where my missing green sock is. I don't know how many of you are actually listening to me now. But these are all trivial things. There's no shortage of things I'm clueless about. But this is different. Not simply that I don't know it, but I cannot know it. Nobody on earth knows when Judgment Day will be. In fact, nobody at any time in history or at any time in the future has known or will know the day or hour. It is unknowable. But that is not all. That sentence in verse 36 continues, "Not even the angels in heaven." Angels appear to be immortal and have presumably observed the universe since its creation. Yet that is not enough to give them knowledge of when the Lord will return. And that's quite amazing, because the angels will play a role in the return of Christ. Near the end of this same speech, in chapter 25, verse 31, Jesus says, "When the Son of Man comes in his glory, and all the angels with him, then he will sit on his glorious throne." The parallel passage in Mark chapter 13, verse 26, says, "They will see the Son of Man coming in the clouds with great power and glory, and then he will send out the angels and gather his elect from the four winds, from the ends of the earth to the ends of heaven." And yet, the angels don't know when this will happen, even though they will be making it happen. The fact that we don't know when Christ will return is not because we're sinful. It's not because we're mortal. The moment of Christ's return is a deep secret, hidden even from immortal beings. The fact that we don't know the day of judgment is not because we're stupid. It's not because humans are limited. It's because the day of judgment is deeply unknowable. But then, verse 36 continues, and you've got to check that this is really in the Bible and that I'm not making this up. Jesus makes an extraordinary statement. "Nor the Son, but the Father only." Jesus does not know when he will return. Even Jesus does not know the day or hour. Let's think about this for a second. Jesus, he is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. "For by him all things were created, in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible. All things were created through him and for him. Without him nothing was made that has been made. He will come again in glory to judge the living and the dead." Yet, he does not know when the return of Christ will be. The judge does not know when Judgment Day is. This means that even if you had godlike knowledge of life, the universe and everything, you would still not know when Jesus will return. Only the Father knows. Now, I think this is one of the most profound statements in the Bible. It gives us a hint as to the relationships inside the Trinity and to the relationship between God and the world. Here we see God the Son submitting to God the Father. Two chapters later, in the Garden of Gethsemane, Jesus will pray to his Father, "Your will be done." Knowing that Jesus does not know the date of his return adds more weight to his obedience to the Father, I think. It's not that he's checked the date. It's trust. He trusts the Father. I had heard this verse when I was a kid, and I thought, okay, this is top secret. This is the one thing that the Father keeps secret from Jesus. But think about it. If Jesus didn't know the day when he'll return, then presumably he didn't know if he'd return within the first 1,000 years. And he didn't know if he would return before AD 2000 or afterwards. That means he didn't know if you and I would be born into a sinful world. He can't have known if we would be needing salvation. On the cross, as he died for the sins of the world, he can't have had a sin list of people whose sins he was dying for. So, in some sense then, Jesus didn't know the future, at least not in the sense that we usually think, not in the way he'd know about the future of a clockwork universe. Well, this is a bit of a problem. A few commentaries seem to think that Jesus' ignorance of the day of his return only applied while he was on earth. And now that he's returned to his Father, he now knows the date of the day of judgment. And they might be right, but I'm not convinced. I can't see anything in this text to suggest that it only applies on earth. I can't see any reason he'd need to know the date after he returned to his Father. I can't see any reason why he couldn't know the date while he was on earth, especially since he knew that he had to die, rise again, and return to his Father before Judgment Day could happen. So knowing the date would not affect his life in any way. And so this is a bit of a monkey wrench thrown in the clockwork of my idea about how God works and how time works, and the relationship between God and the universe. Why does Jesus not know the date? Well, we don't know, but it must be related to his humanity. Maybe he could not have become fully human if he knew when Judgment Day was. And maybe that ignorance is an essential part of being human. And it seems to me that free will could arise from this. Many Christians worry about free will and predestination, and sometimes this leads them to doubt the fairness and goodness of God. I want to be really careful about drawing any firm conclusions from this verse, but what I think it says is that many of our guesses about how time and the future works are totally wrong. We just don't know, and we've got to be really humble about all this stuff. But in any case, the date of Judgment Day is not chosen by Jesus. It's a decision of the Father alone. And that means that, like us, Jesus is waiting. This is a case where he's both fully God and yet fully human, God with us. Jesus is waiting. But Jesus is not teaching theology or philosophy. He wants his listeners to change their lives. He wants them to live their lives in the light of this reality. And as is typical for Jesus, he does this by telling stories. Jesus gives 6 illustrations. There's a lesson from the fig tree, story of Noah and the flood, some agricultural workers, a thief in the night, a returning master, the parable of 10 virgins waiting for a bridegroom, and the famous parable of the talents is in this section as well. The last two of those parables, the parable of the wise and foolish virgins and the parable of the talents, are quite famous and often preached on. But I think the first 5 are relatively neglected. They're very short stories, only a couple of sentences each. They're kind of like those TikTok videos that are very popular these days, where you only need 30 seconds concentration span. First, the fig tree. The lesson from the fig tree comes before the passage we read today, and it's a little bit different from the other stories. All the other illustrations involve people. It's just in verse 22. From the fig tree, learn its lesson. As soon as the branch becomes tender and puts out its leaves, you know that summer is near. So also, when you see all these things, you know that he is near, at the very gates. So the first thing we see is, even though we don't know when he will return, we cannot know, we actually sort of know. When the green leaves come out on the fig trees, you know that winter has gone and summer is coming. You don't know when the first day will be when it's warm enough to go swimming. But you won't be surprised when it happens. It's that time of year. You'll put your winter jacket and your winter boots away and put the toboggan in the cellar. You won't need that. It's not going to snow. You'll look for your sandals and you'll bring out your light clothing. Note that you don't need to know the weather of individual days. Even if summer starts with a few weeks of overcast days, you'll be ready for when the warm days really start. Likewise, you don't take the winter tyres off your car on the first day when there's no ice on the road. They only come off when the season ends. Friends, we are in the season where Christ returns. We don't know the exact day, but it's that time of year. It's the time of year when Judgment Day happens. It's Judgment Day season. The lesson from the fig tree doesn't tell you why it matters, though. So Jesus continues in verse 37 with another little story. The second story comes from ancient history, from the dawn of civilization. Before the flood, people are just living their lives, oblivious to what's about to happen. Eating and drinking, marrying and raising families, partying on. But one day, it started to rain. And as soon as it did, it was too late. They were swept away. Now, Jesus is pretty generous to them when he says they were unaware. God was so unfair, he gave them no hint that there would be a flood. Well, apart from Noah, Noah built the Titanic of the ancient world, held the record for the largest ship in history for a few thousand years. A ship so large that it would cast a shadow over the nearby town. And it took him 100 years to build it. And of course, there's no water in sight. Every stand-up comic in the ancient world would have had a routine about Noah and his ridiculous, gigantic boat in the middle of the desert. It would have been the biggest tourist attraction in the Middle East. Everyone wants to see this boat. We can be quite sure that the whole world knew that Noah believed a flood was coming. And if that wasn't enough, then the exotic animals start arriving. A gigantic ship full of weird animals. For 100 years, not subtle. This is what God means when he says he didn't give any warning. But they ignored the warning. Who knows? Maybe at first they thought Noah could be right, but after a year or two with no sign of rain, they decided he was a fool and went on living their lives. But the relentlessly rising waters caught them by surprise, and they were swept away. So there were warnings, but there were no short-term warnings. And this is the situation that we are in. We have been very clearly warned about the coming judgment of God. But we won't get any alarm clock warning us that it's about to happen. No air raid siren. Jesus is telling us to be like Noah and not like the people who were swept away. But the flood is a story from the dawn of time, pretty distant. Maybe that's too distant to motivate us. So the third story comes from everyday life. Jesus brings it to the present day and everyday experience. Verse 40. Two men will be in the field, one will be taken and one left. Two women will be grinding at the mill, one will be taken and one left. Two people in an office, one taken and one less. Two people on the Strassenbahn, one taken, one left. Two people at a football match in the Red Bull Stadium in Leipzig, one will be taken and the other left. Ordinary life. I don't think that this is a description of what the return of Christ will physically look like, but rather it's the instantaneous nature of it. It could be right here, right now, or at 11:17 tomorrow morning. 3 seconds before, you'll have no idea that it's about to happen. Just as in the days of Noah, some will be ready and some will not. We're not even told anything about the difference between those who are ready and those who are not. It's not like it's the obviously godly people versus the sinful. The two men and the two women are doing exactly the same thing. They may have even had the same thoughts at that moment. They may both be thinking, they're hungry and it must be lunchtime soon. It's not their actions or their thoughts at the time of Christ's return that makes a difference. The difference is their readiness. Therefore, verse 42, stay awake. Stay awake. Can you think of another time when Jesus tells his disciples to stay awake? The Garden of Gethsemane, just before Judas comes to arrest him. Jesus is praying and his disciples are falling asleep, and he tells them to stay awake. That is just 2 days later. And the urgency is similar in both cases. Jesus knows that very soon they will have to survive without him. So they need to stay awake. The fourth illustration, our fourth little TikTok video, in verse 43 is for me very unexpected, because Jesus compares himself to a thief. He's a criminal, breaking into your house in the middle of the night and stealing all your stuff. Well, not really. This is a good example of how sometimes not all the details of Jesus' parables are relevant. I don't think the thief is that important. It's the fact that there's a break-in that matters. The part of this story we're supposed to focus on is the experience of the homeowner and the unpredictability of the time of the break-in. Because a robber who breaks in at a predictable time will have a very short career. The owner of the house will be ready. And maybe the police will be waiting for him as well. If you knew the exact time, you could set your alarm clock and wake up just in time to catch him in the act. And sure, that would prevent your home from being broken into. Unfortunately, that's not how break-ins work. I'm going to find out when the next break-in will happen, and I'll meet the robber just as he's breaking in. Try telling that to your home and contents insurance. Improve your locks, put bars on the windows, maybe even hire a security guard if necessary. But don't try to predict the time of the break-in. Watching the clock will not help you. So, if you're an enemy of Christ, then the return of the Son of Man will be like a robbery. You didn't see it coming, and you lost everything. And Jesus is saying you don't want to be in that situation. But the way to avoid that situation is not to try to determine what day it will be, not by watching the clock. The way to avoid that situation is by being ready. Well, up to now, for those of us who are believers, we haven't been particularly confronted yet. But in the final illustration from this chapter, Jesus addresses his followers. And you might have noticed during the reading that this one is pretty harsh. This is a tale of two employees, one who is good and faithful, and his boss rewards him. But the other one is corrupt and violent and abusive, and his boss cuts him into pieces. If an employer did that in modern day Germany, they would be in considerable trouble. But in ancient Palestine, there wasn't much in the way of labour laws. And so this was the way things worked. Pretty harsh, but if you're falling into complacency, as I am, this is a message to wake you up. Let's take a closer look. Verse 45. There's a servant who's managing the household in his master's absence. For a large estate, this would be a considerable responsibility. This chief servant, the steward, is highly trusted. He has to keep the estate running and has to ensure that all the staff are fed, salaries and so on. In modern terms, he'd be acting general manager, I guess. After a long absence, the master returns. The servant has been wise and faithful. He's done a great job. Everything's under control. Staff are happy. Everything's working well. The master is delighted. Instant promotion. He's in charge of everything now. Truly, I say to you, he will set him over all his possessions. He is set for life. And we want to be this guy. We really do. Verse 48, though, is the same situation, but with a hypothetical wicked servant. And here I think we learn a bit more about what Jesus means when he tells us to be ready. The wicked servant says to himself, "My master is delayed." And he takes the opportunity to abuse his position. He becomes a violent, drunk tyrant. He's physically abusing the other servants, beating them, eating and drinking with drunkards, wild parties every night. His friends are eating all the food which was supposed to be for the staff. He's stealing from the owner, ruining the estate, and he thinks he'll get away with it, because the owner will be away for so long. But unfortunately for him, the owner returns unannounced. Perhaps he heard rumours about what was going on. He finds his property run down, his reputation damaged, and his staff and their families malnourished and covered in bruises. He has the servant executed. The cutting in pieces, I presume, means that he dies in disgrace. We do not want to be like this dreadful man. This story is a harsh warning to those of us who have some kind of leadership role, especially in the church. And sadly, the warning was necessary. There have been many cases in church history of church leaders who have abused their position. And here we see how God feels about that. Abuse in the church matters to God. Pastors, deacons, bishops who abuse their position, injuring God's people and damaging his reputation, will face the full wrath of God. But it's not just leaders. As Jesus continues in speaking in the next chapter, he recounts the parable of the talents, which is a surprisingly similar story to this one in many ways. And that story is quite explicit in saying that though God has given some of us more responsibility than others, and he has more expectations of them, yet he has given each one of us some responsibility, and he has expectations for each one of us. All of us have a role in building God's people. All of us can build up the church or be tearing it down. Each of us can be a wise and faithful servant, or we can be a wicked servant who abuses the talents and the situations which God has given us. This story, though, isn't primarily a call to flee from sin, though of course that's always true all throughout the Bible. This story is primarily about the unexpected return of the master. And the real problem is in verse 48. The wicked servant behaved the way he did because he saw that the master was delayed. And it says he begins to beat his fellow servants. It sounds as though he wouldn't have behaved badly if the master had only been away for a short time. But he says to himself that the return of the master is a long way off, in the distant future. Maybe he'll never come back. So there's no consequences for anything I do right now. Party on. Jesus knows that the long wait is going to be a problem for us. It will be long enough that some will think he's not coming back at all. Already, 2,000 years have passed and he has still not returned. But maybe he'll return in the next 5 minutes. Maybe not for another 9 billion years. We just don't know. But he will return, and we need to be ready for his return. We need to stay awake. The only way we can stay ready, I think, is to encourage one another. Each of us will have times when we nod off. We need to remind one another of the certainty of Christ's return. Some people add the word God willing to the end of every statement they make about the future. And that can be a helpful reminder. The problem is that if you say it in every sentence, it completely loses its impact. But maybe saying something like that every few months would be beneficial to us. And that's the end of the chapter. In the next chapter, Jesus tells two more parables related to his return. Then comes chapter 26, verse 1, which says, "When Jesus had finished saying all these things, he said to his disciples, 'After 2 days, the Passover is coming, and the Son of Man will be delivered up to be crucified.'" Jesus died 2 days later. This was his last public statement. I've kind of bombarded you with a whole lot of ideas today, but that's what Jesus did to his listeners in his last frantic couple of days before he died. With only a few days left of his life, he hammered them with image after image. The fig tree and the start of summer, Noah and the flood, the workers in the field and the mill, the thief in the night, the faithful servant and the wicked servant, and then those other stories with the 5 wise and 5 foolish virgins. In every case, the main message was the same. Judgment day will happen when you will not expect it, so you must be prepared. There will be no short-term warning. Once it starts, it's too late. If you're not prepared, you'll be swept away. So stay awake. If you're not ready, it'll be like a break-in where you lost everything. If you're not ready, it'll be like an employee caught stealing from his boss. The date of the day of judgment is deeply unpredictable. So fundamentally unknowable that even Jesus, the judge, did not know it. The date of the return of Christ may be the most unpredictable thing in the universe. Completely unknowable. Even with godlike knowledge, it's still unknowable. But here's a paradox. It is also the most predictable event in the universe, because it is the only event in the future that is certain. There's the joke about the only certainties are death and taxes. Well, don't bet on death. Everyone dies, that's a fact. But Christ might return in my lifetime. All of us here today, we might not die. Jesus might come back before anybody dies. The sun will rise tomorrow. That's certain. No, it isn't. Christ might return tonight, and this sinful world might be transformed into the new creation. If I drop my keys, I can't even be certain they'll hit the ground. Maybe the Lord will return while they are falling. The only event in the future that is certain is the return of Christ. Even though the timing is completely unknowable, the unknowable timing of his return doesn't matter. We are in the season where Christ returns. It's the most certain thing in the future, and it could happen at any moment. If we live in the light of that certainty, we will be ready. Let's encourage one another to take hold of that certainty.